here in Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's Friday, the 26th of June, 2009, and I'm watching a rehearsal of a military parade, and this is all in preparation for Independence Day here. There's a military brass band walking down the street, and there's civilians on either side watching the rehearsal. The soldiers are all gathered around in a U-shape, thousands of them, and lined up in immaculate order.
Il faut le militaire gagner le civil avec des filets. Oui, c'est comme ça. Bien habillé, bien marché, avec discipline. Ce n'est pas comme ça, oui, c'est comme ça.
Ouais, I will come here this. It is Wednesday, Tuesday. I will come here to look at our president and the manifestation, the meeting.
I'm back in the Monuc compound now, and it's a veritable oasis of calm compared to what it's like in the city. Where I'm sitting, you are looking out over Lake Kivu, and it's just stunningly beautiful. You would think that it was a resort if you didn't know what was going on around its edges. Bizarrely, there's a television that's playing non-stop Michael Jackson, with the news that Michael Jackson just died last night, I believe. It's sort of a surreal experience. I got a bit cornered on coming out of town. This kid came up to me and started talking in a way that was, well, impossible to ignore. He was speaking in French. My translation's not very good, but he took my hand and he said, my mother has died and my father has died. We sat down together and he said that his brother is in America. Could I find his brother? I said, I don't know, but I took down his name. Within sort of 5 minutes, I had a group of 40 around me, including some soldiers wanting beer and cigarettes. Among them were a couple of university students, and I later found out that they're studying here in DRC, but they're actually from Rwanda. Anyway, all the kids that were around started telling me this boy, Jimmy, his name was, he's sad and look, he doesn't have any shoes. And I looked around and it's true that every kid had shoes apart from Jimmy. So I asked the university students, are we able to get Jimmy some shoes? So off we went to the market. And we got Jimmy a pair of sneakers. He seemed happy. I don't know if it was the right thing to do, but I figured since everyone else had them, he probably should as well. It's Saturday, June the 27th, 2009, and I'm in Goma in the Congo at one of the United Nations DDR camps. I'm here with Matthew Brubaker, who is doing DDR from Monuc. So at the DDR camp, there's 5 tents set up and some mattresses on the floor, probably about 20 guys who've just been demobilized in each tent. And they'll be here for a couple of days, and then in front of me I can see the trucks that are going to take them back across the border to Rwanda. Tell us what facilities you have here and how the process works.
Well, this is the main transit center in Goma. We have 12 camp set up throughout North Kivu, and our teams out there will bring in FDLR, CNDP, and other fighters into those camps, and then they'll be transported to this main transit center before they're processed and then repatriated to the countries of origins, which is usually Rwanda.
And how long are they in this transit camp for?
Oh, they can be here one day to a few days.
And what happens to them when they go back to Rwanda?
In Rwanda, they'll be taken by the Rwandan Demobilization Commission, and they'll be taken to a camp called Matobo. And there they'll be given some money, and they'll be able to go see their families. And then they'll have to return to Matobo for about a month long of re-education.
We're about to talk to one of the soldiers who has recently demobilized from FDLR. FDLR being the group that were formed out of the Hutu military that fled across the border to Congo following the Rwandan genocide.
So I'm introducing ourselves. My name's Matthew. I work for DDRRR. Il est avec quel groupe?
FOCA.
He's with FDLR FOCA. FOCA is the military wing of FDLR. Mm-hmm.
How long have you been with the FDLR?
He's there from 1995.
Why is he coming into the DDR program?
So
he's saying that the situation's changed and there's no hope in their original goals, and so he wants to go back to Rwanda.
What do you imagine life will be like for you back in Rwanda?
So he doesn't really know what's going to happen when he goes to Rwanda, but he wants to adapt to the rhythm of the life that's over there. But he's concerned that because he's married to a Congolese, how that his wife is going to adapt to life in Rwanda. Il ne parle pas comme moi qui est une femme congolaise.
Bien bon.
Et quel âge?
Quel âge
a-t-il? A
He's 2 years old. Does he imagine that his son will grow up in Rwanda? What will life be like for his son in Rwanda?
He says God only knows, because it's going to be a completely different life in Rwanda.
Tell us about the impact on the control that this group had over mines in the area and the resource implications of the demobilization and also the military campaign against the FDLR.
Well, FDLR had extensive, still has extensive rackets in terms of mines. They usually don't do the mining themselves. They tax the companies that go to the mines. But they also do trading in gold and trading in palm oil and charcoal. In the north, the Kimia 2 operation, which started in March, which is the joint MONUC FARDC operation, part of its strategy is to establish government control over the mines and take it away from FDLR control, and thereby marginalize the organization from its financial network. And that's pretty much succeeded in the north. It hasn't happened yet in the south. The operation, the military operation, is just starting now in the south. So we'll see if how successful it is. And the rate of return correlates to the military operation. So our repatriation rate is twice as high as it was in 2008, when there weren't any repatriations. And we hope, as the military pressure increases, that we'll be getting more and more FDLR combatants out.
Tell me, does the government really have the capacity to take control over the mines that it takes out of control of the FDLR?
Well, a lot of it's vested interests, even within the FARDC, so it'll be certain commanders that are allocated control over a particular mine, and because they benefit from it financially, then they want to keep control over it. So it's kind of vested interest motivation rather than, you know, for country and kingdom or whatever you call
it. So one assumes that the benefits of this aren't going to the local civilian population?
No, that doesn't happen.